The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. Nice to be with you. I'm probably one of those many people out there who have been following IMC and your activities from a distance, and it's been quite meaningful and inspiring for me. And so now that I live closer by, I'm happy to be practicing with you and sometimes teaching. And thanks for the intro and hosting. You know, the topic today is self and not self, and it's quite helpful to hear your bio read out loud before giving a talk on self and emptiness of self, because I wrote those words, and I don't know who you were talking about, but I know it wasn't me. We could say that there are two primary tasks on the path. And we can put it in different ways, but maybe we could say loving the self and forgetting the self. On the one hand, the Buddha teaches about cultivation. A lot of the teachings are about cultivation, cultivating good qualities, growing and developing the seeds of goodness within. And paired with that whole barrage of teachings are this singular summarizing teaching, which says, cling to nothing whatsoever as I or mine. So how do those fit together? Do they compete with each other? How do we keep those two dimensions or registers of the practice in mind? Generally, there's this a presumed opposition between these two facets of practice, what I'm calling loving the self and forgetting the self. And there's some sense, and I think often in different teachings, a sense that these are competing aspects of our practice, or that somehow loving the self is in competition with insight into the emptiness of self. And so it's said that, you know, the self will sort of cling tenaciously against this insight into emptiness of self, and the freedom from a sense of I am-ness. But I think it's very helpful to distinguish between what might be called self-clinging from what I'm calling self-love or self-kindness. That self-clinging does work against this insight into self-forgetting, fixating a sense of self, clinging to what we think we are, standing guard at that sense of self. This does work, I think, cross purposes with self-forgetting. But self-love and kindness towards oneself, for me, in my mind, is very much supportive of this insight into the emptiness of self. And in fact, maybe we could even say it's on the continuum that self-love, in a certain sense, is affirming, accepting, opening the heart to our experience. And insight into the emptiness of self, we could say, is the radical extrapolation of that, taking that to its end, perhaps, of deeply affirming the self. There's a kind of mutual support between these two things, loving the self and forgetting the self. The self that is loved is easier to forget than the self that is hated or disliked. The self that is, you know, dislike is a kind of little negative obsession with ourselves and who we think we are. And that kind of disliked self and all the constellation of thoughts and feelings about that is very, very kind of sticky. It pools our attention. And we have a kind of ongoing narrative around that. Whereas what I'm calling self-love, it isn't so much like that. It's not some of the obsessiveness with self is released. And it's ultimately, I think, easier, as I said, to let go of the sense of self when it is loved. This is the way that we could say self-love supports self-forgetting. Self-forgetting also supports self-love. That when we have some experiential, intuitive flavor for the insight into the emptiness of self, which I'll talk about, it actually develops more and more heartfelt compassion for the experience of self and its attendant suffering. And so there's this mutually reinforcing relationship between loving the self and forgetting the self. This subject is kind of notorious in Buddhist circles as driving us crazy and being opaque and paradoxical and just annoying and getting the mind really spinning. And I don't see it so much as paradoxical. I think the paradoxes start to come in when we sort of start lapsing into metaphysical theorizing about self and not self, when it starts to get really philosophical, when we start to build metaphysical theory into what is actually... The Dharma is always a description, an uncovering of what's happening now, simply, directly. We could say the Dharma is a study of the phenomena of suffering and freedom from suffering. That's all that matters. That's all that matters to me. And we could say that self is an experience and not self is an experience. And two experiences never contradict each other. They're both valid in their own way. And so a lot of the mind that gets backed into corners around this subject and feels like it's paradoxical, it's the speculative mind. And I think a lot of the teachings actually have not been helpful in that respect, that it stokes the fire of paradox. But I'm not so sure there is such a paradox. So the philosophical question, is there a self, is cast aside. There's this story, I think maybe the Buddha was asked maybe once or twice in the suttas, you know, like, is there a self? Is there no self? There's very few occasions when that, and the famous one is this wanderer, Vachagota, who comes to the Buddha and says, you know, Buddha, is there a self? And the Buddha's silent. And then Vachagota naturally says, well, is there no self? And the Buddha's silent. And then Vachagota, like, is kind of just waiting there and eventually gets up and goes and leaves. And the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, comes over and says, what happened there? Why didn't you, you know, Vachagota's asking questions, why didn't you answer? And the Buddha said, well, if I said yes, would that be in keeping with the teaching on impermanence? And Ananda says, no. Okay. And if I said no, there's no self, would that be, you know, acknowledging the reality of this experience of being alive? And Ananda said no. And so the Buddha says, you know, I didn't answer Vachagota because either answer is confusing, and Vachagota is already confused enough as it is. So I take heart in these the Buddha being willing to put certain questions aside, and as you know, as Tan Jeff said, who will be here tomorrow night, he said, "If you're not suffering, do you care whether there's a self or not? Really?" If the heart is like totally at ease, are we asking philosophical questions? Is there a self? Is there? No, it doesn't matter. The guiding distinction in Dharma practice is this distinction between suffering and freedom from suffering. And any time we get majorly sidetracked, we can just gently return the attention to that key distinction, more important than I think any other. So Jack Angler, a psychologist who's done therapy but long-term practitioner and Buddhist teacher, says this: as a psychologist, part of my effort is to help people develop capacities that may have been underdeveloped or may have been derailed earlier in development or may have been compromised by trauma. So ego in this sense is a positive thing. That's the way I think of it in psychology. But a lot of people who come to me for therapy don't think of ego that way. They think about ego in a spiritual context where it's a bad thing. But talking about ego in a spiritual context, to me, is even more problematic. It gets talked about like it's an alternate personality within me that's bad, gets reified as some part of me that I have to battle with, that I have to transcend. I think spiritual language reinforces a lot of dualistic thinking when we talk about ego that way, unless we're really careful in how we define it. Now, instead of self versus other, it's self versus ego. And so the struggle just continues in another guise. So I want to affirm the importance of self-kindness and cultivation. You know, sometimes people get sometimes some meditators, they're sort of go for broke on having a particular meditative insight, particular series of insights that get called, insight into emptiness of self or some kind of awakening, enlightenment, the first taste of enlightenment. And I think people can successfully have that experience if it's not paired with the cultivation side. It doesn't always lead to a balanced human being, an integrated spiritual life. That the sense of, okay, as long as I have that singular moment of penetrating, liberating insight, then it's going to resolve, it's going to make my life one piece. And that's not really so much what I've seen. That the cultivation side is a critical complement to insight into selflessness. And so we say that self-cultivation is important, self-kindness is important, healing the self is important. And how do we do this? We close our eyes and we make everything relevant. We close our eyes and we make everything relevant. Because everything that we need to learn and needs to be healed will present itself in due time, I believe. That there's a kind of logic of the unfolding of the Dharma, that we close our eyes and what comes up and what seems just like some bizarre intrusion and some pain and some annoyance and memories and anxieties and all of these things that feel like intrusions in our practice, from this perspective are, you know, they are our path. That's our path. It's nowhere else. That's our path. And they're arising for a reason. There's a kind of logic of this thing that if they didn't need to be met with our care, they wouldn't have arisen as a problem in the first place. You know, the fact that it's arisen means we actually can and need to learn something from it, open the heart to it in some way. And it's sort of almost unbelievable that this is actually our practice. It always feels like it's somewhere else, but this is it. Like this aching knee, or this heart feeling like this. And in this process, there's a really an integrating function of mindfulness, of opening to our lives, our experience fully. It's an integrating kind of function where it starts to feel like our life more and more is of one piece. There's a kind of wholeness to it. And in this process, many of our behaviors are transformed and our emotional habits are examined, and often some of the urgency of our emotional habits begin to be diffused over time. The memory, our life, as we've known it, begins to see the light of the Dharma, be seen in the light of the Dharma. That all the things from our past and our place within our family, childhood, all of this arises at some point if we sit enough. And it's like all the difficulties or suffering that we had trouble digesting when it was occurring, is we sort of bless it with a new understanding and a new kindness. You know how I have this image of, you know how in the UK they like knight people, right? And don't they sort of touch a sword to their shoulders? It's kind of a weird thing, but, and I don't know why I had this association, but that's the association I have as our past and memory arises. It's like we are blessing our past, the memory of the past, with understanding and love. And this kind of way of integrating our life and all the different pieces of our experience and our past integrates. And some sense of sweetness for ourself is really feels so natural. And we could say that this process really, it makes our inner life safe. You know, mindfulness, this kind of gathering process makes our inner life safe. We often, you know, there's a place for arranging the conditions of the world of keeping safe in the very traditional sense of safe. But ultimately the safety comes with making our inner life safe. And that arises out of being with, digesting our life, we could say. Mindfulness, I know that's just a metaphor, but there's something like digesting. So, the value, importance of loving the self. But even the well-adjusted self carries a burden of suffering. Even the well-adjusted self carries a burden of suffering, says the Buddha. You know, our ego, self-clinging, I think is with us because it's trying and occasionally succeeding. It's trying to make us look good and ultimately feel good. Right? And there's a kind of innocence, a sort of childlike innocence to that of wanting to look good and feel good. And I had an experience last retreat I did was a long retreat, a long amount of silence, and came out of the retreat, and you know they as many of you no doubt know, in retreats there's sort of like an integration phase where you go from being silent to then talking in sort of like very structured ways and sort of slowly re-entering normal kind of interaction. And so I had a real good retreat, and we started coming out of the silence, and I had this the first One of the first conversations I had was with somebody who happened to mention two different people that I know and am friends with. And it was just a random kind of connection. But after all these months of silence, it like so deeply stimulated the sense of self that I just like kind of like was like, I know him, I'm friends with them, rambling, goofy, kind of like regressed, sort of very strong identification with self, and trying to demonstrate, in some ways, demonstrate my worth or something. Very kind of humbling, right? And we get to see, you know, sometimes the ego sort of like pulls it. In this case, it did not pull it off. I did not look good. I didn't, I definitely did not feel good. Yeah, the image I had of myself was like this, like a golden retriever, like just running through a family picnic, you know, stepping in the food. That was actually the image that I had of myself in that moment. And so in this case, it backfired. It like, it clearly backfired, and the posturing just, I didn't pull it off. So, but even when we do pull it off, you know, even in those moments when we do pull it off, when you look from the eyes of wisdom, you know, it's sweet, but we look a little silly, you know, like at least a little bit silly. The image I have is like, remember like from fifth grade doing show and tell? You know, and you'd bring in like your favorite rock or something, or doll or baseball cards or something, and you'd get up in front of the room and show everybody, this is my rock. And kind of childlike pride in that. And it's sweet, right? But how, you know, how often do we do that as adults in similar ways? You know? And it's so sort of like that's the cultural currency, so it seems so natural and normal to do, but yeah. This is Rumi. Don't run around this world looking for a hole to hide in. There are wild beasts in every cave. If you live with mice, the cat claws will find you. The only real rest comes when you're alone with God. Live in the nowhere that you come from, even though you have an address here. You have eyes that see from that nowhere, and eyes that judge distances, how high and how low. You own two shops, and you run back and forth. Try to close the one that's a fearful trap, always getting smaller. Checkmate this way, checkmate that. Keep open the shop where you're not selling fish hooks anymore. You are the free swimming fish. So as we talk about these, the emptiness of self, self-forgetting, we're envisioning it from the perspective of self, from self, some degree of self-clinging, and naturally the self seeks to reestablish its ground. And so if you notice the mind that gets very analytical around this theme, or some little bit of restlessness around it, it's a little bit of... I think often the sense of self being feeling threatened. And that sense of threat is an important cue to what the Buddha was talking about, how even a well-adjusted self carries some burden. So Ajahn Sumedho very helpfully adds that, the personality doesn't get enlightened. It's not like enlightenment is the perfection of self-love. It's actually a kind of a different register, we could say. Not competing, but a different register of experience. So how do we relate to this, work with this? The practice of insight into not-self, we could say, is examining everything we take ourselves to be and seeing not. And that begins with our kind of self-conceptions, our all the long list of yeses and noes. I am this, I am not that. All the fixations, identifications as this or that. Also, there is maybe a little more subtle than this, the very sense of I am-ness, the sense that it's like awareness is itself flavored by me. There's a sense of awareness being flavored by me. Sense of here's Matthew, but there's a mini Matthew in here, like at the center. And is it in the brain? Is it in the heart? But it's probably in there at the center somewhere, receiving this experience, something to be defended. Like that inner sanctum. And a lot of times this arises out of, what is our home base? Where do we return to? What feels like home in our minds? Often, because it's so ubiquitous and cozy in a way, our inner dialogue, like the voice of thinking, it feels like our home. It creates a sense of home. So when the bell rings at the end of a meditation, we default to a certain place. You know that moment of the bell's rung, right? Where the mind goes in that moment is really important. In a certain way, it goes back to what it thinks is its home base. And that feels like me, feels like coming home. But there are deeper ways of coming home than that. We learn to notice this place of ground, the sense of the home base of me. And this ground is groundless too. We start to see that sense of place, that sense of I am-ness, that home base of Matthew, arises out of a tangle of experience, out of a tangle of thought and feeling primarily. that it's not just the obvious layers of thought that we need to bring mindfulness to, but it's the subtle background thoughts that are perhaps so subtle that we don't notice them at all as thoughts. They create the place of self. They create the place of self, the home, our home base. But thoughts all have the same nature, to arise and pass. And so we start to listen more deeply. We get quiet and we listen more deeply. We start to bring that very sense of self and home base into awareness. To know it as not our home. And this process of infusing our experience with more and more mindfulness, more and more equanimity, love, affirming what is there. Not trying to push it away or reject these thoughts, feelings of I am-ness, but affirming it, loving it to death, as my teacher says. As we do this, as we infuse more and more mindfulness into the subtler aspects of our experience, a kind of new vista opens, and we do come home in a deeper sense. To what? That question's not so important. What's important is that there's no suffering. And it's like the front edge of our perspective, the sense of self here, world there, the sense that there's somehow some kind of film or something separating us from life. That the self actually takes us out of life in a certain way. It creates this like a fundamental alienation from life. But we rejoin life. We come into, it's like mind and body rejoins nature, it doesn't rejoin, but we know it as nature. And we're a part of the world in a way that is not, where that alienation is gone. And so the suffering level, that subtle rumbling idol of suffering, falls away. And the difference between a little bit of suffering and no suffering is critical. And so then we know in a certain way that for all of our life we've been standing guard at this sense of self, and we've been protecting a phantom. Like really protecting a phantom. And the face of this insight is not coolness. I think the face of this insight is love. And that's its expression in the world, is love. Love for the self, love for the world. And so there's a kind of feedback mechanism, self-forgetting supports self-love. Like, how could we not love ourselves? This is Norman Fisher. When you actually enter the path and go down a little way and then wake up one day and realize, to your surprise, you're actually committed to this. When that happens, a whole other life comes into view. You find out that you have formed your life literally around your practice, and you begin to forget about the life you thought you wanted, the life you thought you were making, the life you were hoping for, the life you thought you should have been having. Instead, practice becomes your life, and life becomes your practice. Practice is no longer something you do to enhance your life or help it along. It is your life. One day, you kind of realize this, and you lose the life you thought you wanted or the life you thought you had. But this is very liberating. This is really great. It's wonderful to disappear into your practice. It's wonderful not to have to worry anymore about being somebody or something, which is such a struggle. And you no longer have to work overtime to avoid life's difficulties. People work their entire lives to avoid life's difficulties, and they're never successful at that. You can give up that effort altogether. You don't have to defend or protect yourself anymore. This is great. I can't tell you how great this is. It's not dramatic. It's not colorful. It's not a big deal. It's very subtle. Maybe nobody even notices. So let's just sit for a moment together, please. Whatever goodness is here in this room this morning, may it remind you of the goodness in yourself. Goodness naturally spills over the bounds of our own heart. It spills out. May this be so. May our goodness, whatever joy or freedom or ease, whatever kindness is our own, may this be of benefit to all beings we encounter. So thank you. Thanks for your attention.